Word on Today FM.
We're joined today for the Culture Club by the acclaimed novelist Hugo Hamilton, who has a new novel, Conversations with the Sea. Hugo, great to have you back on The Last Word again with us. Tell us all about Conversations with the Sea.
Well, it's the novel is a bit like a breakup song. You know the way Taylor Swift says the breakup songs are the best, the only ones that matter? I've written this novel a bit like a breakup song. This guy, Lucas Dorn, comes from Berlin and he arrives in Achill Island, you know, trying to look for his past. It's where he went on honeymoon with his wife and they're now broken up. So he ends up there with his journal and he's talking to the sea. That's his only companion. And he brings up all these dark things in his childhood as well. When he found out about the Holocaust from his father was a Holocaust scholar. That was quite traumatic at the age of 9 when he found out about all of that. And the guest house where he's staying, the woman of the house, she knows there's something wrong with him. He's one of these Germans with sort of a deep heart. And she's afraid for him walking along these empty coastline, along empty beaches and cliffs and things like that. So there is a sort of a, yeah, he doesn't know what to do with himself, with his sorrow.
Okay. The German thing is a major part of your life and of your work, isn't it?
Oh, it is, yeah. Well, my mother was German and my father was this revolutionary Irish man from West Cork. So I've always had a foot in both countries. Yeah, and so this book in a way sort of examines the silence in Germany at the moment. It's a kind of a silence on what's happening in Gaza and that sort of oppressive.
And can you explain that, why there is that silence? Is it their guilt?
It is their guilt in a way, yeah. And they've always sort of lined up behind Israel. It was almost like a form of, you know, washing away the guilt, but also was a sort of a pragmatic thing in a way with it, where Germany needed to find a way back into the international community. And backing Israel was a way of sort of achieving that kind of dignity in the world and of course, getting investments into their economic powerhouse.
Can you ever see Germany been brave enough to call out Israel for its behaviour in Gaza?
I don't know. I think it's very deeply ingrained in the society, not just in the government, but also in the cultural institutions. You see how heavy-handed the police are on the streets of Berlin now, you know, arresting a 13-year-old girl, you know.
Assaulting an Irish woman and seriously injuring her.
Yeah. I mean, there is a sort of a huge repression in Germany. I saw that kind of repression in the 70s when the Bader Meinhof were underway, you know. But that's kind of worrying, like that Germany cannot change. I mean, Germany effectively should be the first country in the world to recognise what's happening now in Gaza. And it doesn't seem to be changing. You know, the young people are out there on the streets, but...
You still, though, retain a great love of Germany, though, don't you? As much as Ireland?
Well, I do. You know, it's my mother's country. When I'm back there in Berlin, it feels like being in the kitchen with my mother. It's a wonderful feeling. I love speaking German. I don't think German people are without empathy. And I think they're wonderful people, you know, very concerned about the world. But this somehow seems to be cast a silence over the country. That's kind of very strange and worrying.
Okay, let's move to your Culture Club choices because we have asked you for to answer the various questions we ask our guest every week. And the first single that you ever remember buying, if you have a memory of that.
Well, it was that single "Get Back" with "Don't Let Me Down" on the flip side. It actually caused me a lot of trouble. You know, I saved up for it, and then. What happened was like that the only record player that we had at home was this wonderful sound system that my father had built for himself, and he had components brought in from Sweden and Germany and everywhere. And it was always locked up. And I found where the keys were hidden. And so I went in there when my father was out at work and opened it up and put on Don't Let Me Down repeatedly, 10 times in a row, blasting it all over the street. And the trouble was then that when I locked it all up, I actually left the single on the turntable. And he found it then later on, you know. And of course, there was war in the house after that, you know.
Right. Did he not appreciate the fact that you'd love of music and that you wanted to use the contraption he'd built? Or was it just too valuable to be trusted to a child's hands?
Oh, I think it was, the only kind of music that he would tolerate on the turntable was Mahler and Beethoven.
Oh, it was your choice of music more than anything else?
It was a choice, yeah. It was kind of, also it was kind of bringing British culture straight into the house, and that was had been forbidden, you know.
Well, let's hear a little bit from the B side of the Beatles' Get Back, still a very famous song, Don't Let Me Down. Did that song start a lifelong love of the Beatles?
It did, and but especially John Lennon, his kind of revolutionary ideas, you know. I really like the crazy songs, like, you know, Working Class Hero, those kind of songs.
Favourite album? And the favourite album that you've nominated is David Bowie's Heroes from 1977. Why Bowie?
Well, I was always a fan of Bowie. Right from the beginning, you know. But I'd like to boast that I got to Berlin before he did. I got there in 74 and he got there in 76 or 78. And whenever I go there now, it's I stay in a place that's very close to where he stayed at the time with Iggy Pop. And they were mad years, you know. And I like to remember that. I'm also... like the song Heroes, I'm one of those people who can proudly say I stood with my back to the wall. Okay, you can still do that maybe with a stretch of the wall that's still left. But I come from that era, and this is kind of, Heroes is in a way the soundtrack to my life when I lived there in Berlin. He did it a version of it in German and in English together, which he sang to both sides. He sang it across the wall.
So he sang on the western side, but it could be clearly heard on the eastern side.
It could be clearly heard, yeah, in the east. So that was a great cultural event in a way, you know.
And I believe you sing it yourself occasionally and throw in Irish alongside the English and German.
I do. I love singing that song, and I throw in this Irish, you know, instead of, you know, we can be heroes, I sing Sin in a Leachra. And then in German as well, wir sind dann Helden. I love the idea of sort of trotting out all my three different languages from childhood.
Well, rather than your version, let's hear a little bit from Bowie's own album. Here's the title track from Heroes.
Away. We can beat them
Oh, such a wonderful song, David Bowie's Heroes. Hugo Hamilton is with us for the Culture Club. And I don't think it's uncommon from people of your generation, Hugo. It's happened quite a few times on the Culture Club for you to people to nominate Bob Dylan as favourite artist. Tell us why. What does Bob Dylan mean to you?
I love a lot of the new bands. I'm really into the Fontaines, DC, and...
And you've already name-dropped Taylor Swift as well.
Yeah, and Billie Eilish and people like that. But, you know, if I was sent out on a desert island, you know, out in the west of Ireland somewhere, I'd have to take Blonde on Blonde with me. You know, this is Dylan's famous album. I still think he comes from a revolutionary time in the world that sort of marked huge change after the Second World War. You know, the time when the Vietnam War was going on, it would never end. And so he had that sort of great charisma and that social instinct. And it's not a surprise in a way that he got the Nobel Prize for Literature for his wonderful lyrics.
Well, is it the lyrics rather than the vocals that would attract you to his music?
It's both together. Like, I mean, sort of the vocals kind of give flight to their lyrics. But yeah, it's these wonderful words. I mean, there's a new song, you know, Hard Rain now has been re-recorded by a group called the Kronos Quartet. And they do a wonderful version of these lyrics, like, you know, I see a black branch with blood dripping from it. You know, those are kind of very lasting kind of images that he comes up with in his songs, you know, and that really sort of stand the test of time, and they really sort of describe what we're going through right now.
Let's hear from that album, Blonde on Blonde, which is actually 1966 Bob Dylan album, Visions of Joanna.
Ain't it just like the night to play tricks when you're trying to be so quiet? We'll sit here stranded, but we're all doing our best to deny it. And Louise holds a handful of rain, tempting you to defy it. Lights flicker from the opposite loft. In this room the heat pipes just cough. The country music station plays soft, but there's nothing, really nothing to turn off. Just Louise and her lover so entwined. Of Johanna that conquer my mind.
Bob Dylan from Blonde on Bond, Visions of Johanna. Best gig you were ever at. This is somebody I have to admit I've never heard of. Definitely has never come up in all the years we've been doing the Culture Club. Niels Frahm.
Yeah, Niels Frahm. My son, who lives in Berlin, brought me to a concert about a year ago in the Tone Studio. It's one of these sort of big recording studios they had in the east part of Berlin, and which it was completely abandoned after the wall came down. Everybody just left their desks behind. And a number of artists took it over and basically lived there and record there. And Niels Frahm is one of them. And the studio has this fantastic concert hall where you sit on these steps and listen, can listen to him. He's well known for the fact that as a child, he dreamed of becoming a pilot. And his father said, oh no, I don't want you to be a pilot. So he bought him a piano instead. And you see him now in that concert hall, and it's almost like he's flying a plane with all these different pianos and keyboards all around him. And it's a hugely vibrant kind of energetic type of beaty kind of music. I love it. I have a recording of that event when I went there. And you're allowed, in German concerts, you're allowed to bring a bottle of beer in with you. And there's a lovely sound of a beer bottle rolling away down down the steps in the recording I have. And I love that. It's very real.
I don't think this is the recording we have anyway. This is Niels Frahm performing at the Ton Studio in Berlin, taken from the concert movie Tripping with Niels Frahm. We need to take a break on the Culture Club. Hugo Hamilton is staying with us. He's just published his new novel, Conversations with the Sea. We will be back with more after this. Welcome back to the Culture Club here on The Last Word of Today FM. Hugo Hamilton is our guest this week. His new novel is Conversations with the Sea. But before we get to your favourite author's favourite movie, and you've nominated one, and one of its stars was a guest here on the programme only last year. Richard E. Grant was in with us. Whitnell and I from 1987 remains your favourite. For those who aren't familiar with the movie, tell them about it.
It's this wonderful, crazy movie that was made in the 70s about a two people who live in a sort of a squalid apartment in London, and all they can think about is drink and drugs. And it describes kind of a psychedelic era full of madness. And I don't think people would understand, young people now wouldn't understand the craziness of that time, where they lived for the booze and the drugs, and they go on this kind of outing to the countryside, and everything goes wrong. It's a movie I put on once a year at least. I know it off by heart, but it describes that kind of wonderful time in Britain, where it came to the end of the empire, and it came to the end of this kind of psychedelic era at the same time. It's a melancholic but incredibly funny story.
Okay, well, we have a clip from it, which features Whitnell, played by Richard E. Grant, and Marwood, played by Paul McGann, the two unemployed actors lamenting their financial situation.
Why don't you ask your father for some money? If we had some money, we could go away.
Why don't you ask your father? It's going to be so cold in here, like Greenland in here. We've got to get some booze. It's the only solution to this intense cold. Something's got to be done. We can't go on like this. I'm a trained actor reduced to the status of a bum. I mean, look at us. Nothing that reasonable members of society demand as their rights. No fridges, no televisions, no phones. Much more of this, I'm going to apply for Meals on Wheels.
What happened to your cigar commercial?
That's what I want to know. What happened to my cigar commercial? What happened to my agent? Bastard must have died.
September. It's a bad patch.
Rubbish. I haven't seen Gilgit down the Labour Exchange. Why doesn't he retire? Oh, look at this little bastard. Oh, he lands plum roll for top Italian director. Of course he does. Probably on a tenner a day, and I know what for. £2.10 a tip and a fiver for his arse. Have you been at the controls?
What are you talking about?
The thermostats. What have you done to them?
I haven't touched them.
Then why has my head gone numb? I must have some booze. I demand to have some booze!
Whitnell and I. Okay, favourite play. You've gone for Samuel Beckett's Crap's Last Tape.
Yeah, well, that was almost like a piece of Beckett there, the two of them sort of in this place that goes nowhere. No, Crap's Last Tape is actually, yeah, it's one of my favourite plays ever. This man, every now and again, comes across, he loops through the tapes in the past. Every now and again, he comes across this moment of love in his life. But it's so intense, he can't listen to it. So he skips over it. And every now and again, it comes back again. It's painful. But in the end, he comes to the conclusion like that at his late stage in life, he still has great fire in him. And he wouldn't want those times back. He says, not with the fire in me now. I mean, it's a wonderful line and a wonderful energy coming from this older man.
We actually have a little bit to play of it because it's a one-act play with a cast of one man, originally written by Beckett for the Northern Irish actor Patrick McGee, and I believe was first entitled The McGee Monologue. So let's hear a little bit of Crap's Last Tape performed by Patrick McGee.
Spiritually, a year of profound gloom and indigence, until that memorable night in March at the end of the jetty in the howling wind, never to be forgotten, when suddenly I saw the whole thing, the vision at last. This, I fancy, is what I have chiefly to record this evening against the day when my work will be done and perhaps no place left in my memory, warm or cold, for the miracle that for the fire that set it alight. What I suddenly saw then was this, that the belief I had been going on all my life, namely... Red granite rocks, the foam flying up in the light of the lighthouse and the wind gauge spinning like a propeller, clear to me at last that the dark I have always struggled to keep under is in reality my most... unshatterable association, until my dissolution of storm and night with the light of the understanding of the fire. My face in her breasts and my hand on her. We lay there without moving, but under us all moved, and moved us gently, up and down, and from side to side. Past midnight, never knew such silence. The earth might be uninhabited.
Patrick McGee performing Crap's Last Tape. I see Gary Oldman apparently did it recently in London. You can imagine would be an extraordinary performance given the things he has done.
Yeah, and Stephen Ray, I think, is doing it now. So that sounds great.
Okay, favourite book or author? A book called Emigrants by W.G. Sebald. Tell us about this.
Yeah, W.G. Sebald, or Max Sebald as he's known, wrote these wonderful books about emigrants. He was kind of conscious of everything that happened in the Second World War and in the Nazi era, and conscious of those kind of refugees that came from that time. And he goes to Manchester, one of the grimmest cities, and he loves this description of Manchester, a dark, bleak place. He sort of almost sort of picked the worst place in the world to go to write his books. And there he met this artist called, by the name of Frank Auerbach. And he was remarkable because he used to paint portraits of people he knew. And then when the painting was finished, he would start scraping at the portrait until there's virtually nothing left. All he had then was the dust on the floor of his studio and the dust all over himself. And he almost becomes like a sort of a transparency, a sort of a negative, a photographic negative of the world and all his of himself. I thought that was hugely lyrical, and you know, the power in that image of a man who sort of scrapes away and who's left with nobody, almost no memory of the people he knew. I think that was a wonderful way. I wish I could have written that.
Let's move to television. Although you don't have much television to talk about, do you?
Well, no, we didn't have a television.
Your father wouldn't let you use the record player, and he wouldn't have a television for you either.
Television. He eventually sort of succumbed to and sort of broke all his own rules and did buy a TV, and he loved Kojak and things like that. So, but yeah, I mean, I do like television. I'm kind of with half an eye, I'm looking at Traitors now. You know, it's just out of curiosity. But I don't look at a lot of television. You know, I like movies a lot more, you know.
Yes, indeed. And let's move on, Soto, in that case, to podcasts. Tell us a little bit about your favourite podcast.
One of my favourite podcasts is this one called The Grey Area. Sean Illing, like how he's kind of a philosopher. He has a lot of sort of philosophers, commentators about the world. And he recently had somebody from the tech world talking about sort of the fear of AI taking over the world. Those are kind of great issues.
Is that something you fear? Would you fear, for example, that we're going to be all reading books produced by AI rather than the creative works of the imagination of real people?
In theory, that's the fear. I mean, they've already sort of taken a few of my books into the AI sort of collective. So there's no copyright at the moment on that kind of thing. But no, I actually feel optimistic about AI. You know the way when photography came in, it sort of unleashed this great era of abstract art. You had sort of Picasso and sort of Jackson Pollock and all these people emerged from that time, because there's no point in rendering a painting of the landscape the way it is. You had to do something ridiculous or weird with it. I think that's going to happen now. When AI will turn everything into, you know, it'll become a sort of an era of mediocre art, and it'll take the weird artists, the kind of really constructive,
to do the things that have never been done before, because AI is only amalgamation of everything that's been done previously rather than imagined for the future. Yeah. We have a clip from that podcast with Sean Illing. This is a different one, though. This is with the philosopher Ingrid Robbins on The Grey Area about her call to cap the amount of wealth that a person should be allowed to accumulate.
When someone asks you, what's a limitarian? What is your simplest answer?
Limitarianism is just a view that there should be an upper limit to how much personal wealth a person can accumulate. So just like there's a poverty line, nobody should fall below the poverty line, there should be an upper limit where nobody should be situated above.
Well, that begs the rather obvious question. What's the upper limit? How much money is too much money?
So for me, the real important thing is the reasons we have for putting an upper limit. And the reasons would point us into a certain direction for an upper limit. So in the book, I do give a number, because otherwise people might say, yeah, I agree with limitarianism. Let's put the limit at 1 billion. But I say, no, 1 billion is way too high. So I propose in the book two limits. One is a political limit of 10 million euros in a context such as the Netherlands. And I should stress this, because this means with a healthcare system that is regulated and is a private-public mix, and also with a public pension system. And then there is a second limit, which is the personal voluntary limit, which I put at 1 million euros. And that is really where, based on research I did with my colleagues from economic sociology, if you have more money than that, really it doesn't add to your quality of life.
Okay, that is Sean Illing, and that is the end of today's Culture Club. Hugo Hamilton has been with us. His new novel is Conversations with the Sea. Hugo, it has been great having you here in the programme with us.
Thank you very much, Matt.
The Last Word on Today FM.